From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, researchers at UW-Milwaukee look at the long-term effects of what are known as adverse childhood experiences.
10 experiences of abuse or neglect or household dysfunction constitute the adverse childhood experiences that we consider as the 10 original ACEs.
Then, in honor of National Teacher Appreciation Week, we'll talk with one local educator about his experiences in the classroom and his reasons for staying with the profession.
And what happens to the automotive industry when self-driving or autonomous cars become the norm?
I think the unintended consequence for the car companies will be we don't really need so many car companies because there's going to be no difference in the cars as far as their performance.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
Good morning, this is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Early childhood experiences have a profound impact on the way human beings develop, from core functions like talking and walking to more nuanced emotional responses. What happens to us in our early years quite literally changes our lives.
ACEs, an acronym for Adverse Childhood Experiences, are at epidemic proportions in Milwaukee, according to researchers at UWM. Dr. Dimitri Topitsis and Dr. Joshua Mirsky are both associate professors at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare. They helped launch the Institute for Child and Family Well-Being, where they researched the impact of ACEs and look for ways to solve the issues.
I sat down with the researchers, and Dr. Topitsis starts by describing the different types of ACEs first identified by researchers in the initial CDC Kaiser study published in 1998.
They identified five forms of abuse or neglect and five forms of household dysfunction. Abuse or neglect being childhood physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, neglect being physical or emotional neglect. And then there were five forms of household dysfunction that oftentimes attend these different forms of abuse and neglect, including divorce or separation of a parent who's been incarcerated or a family member has been incarcerated, family member who's struggling with substance abuse, a family member who's struggling with mental health related issues, including suicidality, and then finally, intimate partner violence. So these 10 experiences of abuse or neglect or household dysfunction constitute the adverse childhood experiences that we consider as the 10 original ACEs. And it just so happens a couple of themes emerged from the study of these adverse childhood experiences in the mid-1990s. Number one, they occur at much higher rates than initially thought of. Number two, they tend to cluster. So that if somebody experiences one adverse childhood experience, the likelihood is that they're going to experience two or more. And number three, and perhaps most importantly, these adverse experiences, including abuse or neglect, forecast poor health later in life. And by poor health, we mean something as base as poor physical health, heart disease, cancer, cardiopulmonary obstructive disorder, et cetera. But we also mean something as nuanced as poor behavioral health, like alcoholism, or poor mental health, like depression or anxiety. And the public health revolution that emerged in the mid-1990s by virtue of this original ACE study was that we realized that exposure to these 10 different events was related to poor health in a dose-response manner. In other words, the greater the number of adversities to which I am exposed, the more likely my health later in life is going to be compromised.
Now, you said the prevalence of ACEs was much higher than initially expected. How much higher are we talking about?
Well, the original ACE study, which was conducted with over 14,000 sample members of a San Diego health maintenance organization, found that well over 60% of the sample, and this was a middle-class sample that had health insurance, well over 60% of that sample had been exposed to one adverse childhood experience. And these experiences are, quote-unquote, traumatic in nature. Anything from exposure to sexual abuse, exposure to intimate partner violence, exposure to household incarceration. And these were epidemiological figures. In other words, rates, prevalence rates that were much higher than we expected to see. One caveat is that second-generation studies, including studies that Josh Omirsky and myself have conducted, have indicated that when we replicate this survey or these measures, these ACE measures amongst low-income, high-risk samples, for instance, that hail from central city neighborhoods of Milwaukee, then the prevalence rates of exposure to adverse childhood experience actually increases significantly. So from 60-some percent, now we're talking about 80 to 90-some percent of the sample have been exposed to at least one childhood adversity. So second-generation studies have found that not only is this a public health problem, but it's a deep-end social welfare problem, meaning that those who are of low-income and high-risk nature, those who grew up in low-income, high-crime neighborhoods, for instance, are exposed to adversity at even higher rates than those original numbers suggested.
Now, there was a piece recently in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that drew on work, on both of your work. It said that there was an epidemic of ACEs in Milwaukee. When we're talking about an epidemic, what do we really mean by that?
Rates of exposure to adversity are nearly universal, meaning that nearly 100% of the sample has been exposed to at least one childhood adversity. So, for instance, I conducted a study with patients who are accessing community-based primary care clinics in high-risk neighborhoods of Milwaukee. And what we found is that well over 90% acknowledged exposure to at least one adverse childhood experience. And then what we also found is that the implications of this exposure manifested as health-related problems, mental health-related problems, behavioral health-related problems. So an epidemic, meaning that the vast majority of adults raised in high-crime and low-income neighborhoods of Milwaukee have been exposed to significant adversity. And that exposure has implications for health and well-being.
When we're talking about the implications of ACEs later in life, what are we really talking about? It seems like, at least according to your studies, that people who have had, who've been affected by more ACEs, as it were, have a much higher chance of having alcoholism, having adverse kind of life outcomes.
That's right. Right. These are all probabilities. That's exactly right. There's nothing is predetermined or set in stone. These are all probabilities. If I've been exposed to, say, four or more different types of adverse childhood experiences, the chances that I will engage in addictive behaviors of one kind or another are much increased, sometimes on the order of a magnitude of 7, as opposed to if I had not been exposed to any form of childhood adversity. So exactly right. We're talking about probabilities here.
So you're in Milwaukee. We're in Milwaukee right now. And a lot of your studies look at Milwaukee specifically. But is the city different than other cities? Do we know if how Milwaukee compares to even someplace close like Chicago or Detroit?
What we can say is that the original ACE study that Dimitri mentioned is sort of the ship that launched 1,000 ships. There have been many replication studies since that original study. And basically, study after study has shown that ACEs are prevalent and consequential, right? And so there is no reason to believe that Milwaukee is in some way unique from many other urban centers across this land. What I will say, however, is that we would be remiss if we painted ACEs as something that is unique to an urban landscape. Actually, in our research, we found that within Wisconsin, rates of ACEs are actually even higher among rural populations than they are in urban populations. In fact, we found that American Indians as well as Caucasians who live in rural communities report even higher rates of adverse childhood experiences than do Latinas and African Americans from, say, Milwaukee or Racine.
Now, how are these studies generally being conducted?
Again, excellent question. The vast majority of the research is based on self-report, which makes a lot of sense, right? So what we do is, and Dimitri and I have developed a tool, for example, called the Childhood Experiences Survey that we use. And it's very simple. You sit down with someone and ask them questions, or you can administer it through a paper and pencil survey and just for example, in a primary care setting, you can just give somebody a clipboard and have them fill out this kind of survey. In fact, there are online tools where you can go online and get your ACE score, if you will. There are some limitations to that approach. Self-report is, you know, subject to certain kinds of biases, memory bias, subjectivity, et cetera. But until somebody figures out a better way to capture someone's experience other than their own personal report, then that's what we're pretty much left with.
When we think especially of like community violence, a word that I think gets bandied around a lot is PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
When we're talking about ACEs, how do they contribute to something like PTSD?
That's a great question. So PTSD is a mental health diagnosis that has generally worked relatively well when capturing a one-time event, exposure to a one-time event primarily in adulthood. But it doesn't do an exceptionally accurate job of capturing symptom clusters that emerge after exposure to multiple traumatic events that take place in childhood. So whether or not PTSD describes the aftermath, the mental health, for instance, mental health diagnosis that might emerge subsequent to exposure to a number of early adverse childhood experiences is really up for question. And there are a good deal of trauma studies experts who would argue that PTSD only captures, say, a sliver or a particular sort of segment of experience for those who have been exposed to early adversity. Exposure to these types of events early in life can lead to really distinct outcomes across a number of different individuals. So in one person, it ultimately might manifest as PTSD, but it could very well manifest as depression or as physical ailment or as a substance use disorder with some underlying problems when it comes to the term that's often used is self-regulation. Ultimately, exposure to early adversity, it appears anyway, ultimately undermines one's ability to regulate and manage their own emotions, their relationships, their identity. It tends to be a problem of regulation, of self-regulation, for reasons that we could talk about at some length. Exposure to adversity tends to be a regulatory problem, and it could manifest as PTSD, but it could manifest as a number of other types of presentations.
Well, looking at a different kind of regulatory problem, I mm-hmm. guess, when we know that we have such a high prevalence of ACEs, what do we do? What are the next steps? We recognize that there's an issue. How do we fix things?
I think that's really the frontier of second-generation ACE research is answering that so what question, Joy. And that is, again, what Dimitri and I dedicate a lot of our work to trying to unlock that puzzle. So we collaborate together at the Institute for Child and Family Well-Being, which is a partnership between UW-Milwaukee and Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. And much of what we focus on is translating the knowledge that has been generated from studies like the original ACE study and trying to figure out how can we apply that knowledge and translate it into meaningful programs and policies that can help to either remediate the effects of ACEs. So for people who have been exposed to ACEs, what can we do to help reduce their pain and suffering? But also then ultimately, what can we do to potentially prevent ACEs from occurring in the first place? And we have some preliminary ideas along those lines that we have out in the field. So I'll talk about one potential approach. So in my role at UWM and at the Institute, I have been the lead evaluator for the state's Family Foundation's home visiting program since 2011. And home visiting programs, for those people who are maybe not be familiar with them, they're a broad class of interventions that are designed primarily to work with economically disadvantaged families, primarily women, and women who are either pregnant or who recently gave birth. These programs are diverse in nature, but what they tend to try to do is to promote maternal and child health. So when a woman is pregnant, making sure that she stays healthy, that she's mentally healthy, she's eating properly, et cetera, and that she has healthy birth outcomes. Second goal of these programs is to promote positive and sensitive parenting practices, right, to promote healthy attachment and to certainly reduce the risk of, say, abuse and neglect. And the third goal of these programs is to promote child development, to make sure that children are developing appropriately over time. Well, one of the things that we've done within the context of these programs is to actually integrate this assessment tool that I mentioned earlier, the Childhood Experiences Survey that Dimitri and I developed. And basically what happens is home visitors now, as a result of our work with the state, they now go out during their home visits after they've established rapport with these families, and they ask these women about their experiences of adversity during childhood. And they use that tool now as an opportunity to learn more about the family, to learn more about their experiences, but also to guide their practice with the family, and potentially to use it as a means of referring families to particular services, but also potentially to help the caregivers gain greater insight into their own personal histories and how their own histories may be linked to particular challenges or difficulties that they're facing in their current life. So to sum up, one approach that we can do, one thing that we can do to address ACEs is to ask about them. And there's been a long debate sort of in the literature about, should we ask people about their adversity? Should we be asking them about their trauma? And what the research will tell you is that there is a resounding yes to that question, that actually the vast majority of people not only are able to tolerate those kinds of questions, but many people actually appreciate being asked about their histories.
Well, thank you both so much for coming in and sharing your work with me, and I look forward to hearing more about it.
Thanks so much, Joy.
Thank you.
Dr. Dimitri Topitsis and Dr. Joshua Mirsky are both associate professors at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UWM. Together, along with the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin, they launched the Institute for Child and Family Well-Being. For more information, go to WUWM.com.
It's National Teacher Appreciation Week, and coming up next, we'll talk with one local educator about why he chose the profession. Lake Effect continues on WUWM right after this. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Around the country, communities are celebrating Teacher Appreciation Week. In honor of that, we're showing our appreciation for a local educator who took an interesting path into the profession.
You might know Julio Pabon as the percussionist for Milwaukee's leading Latin jazz group, De La Buena. But what you might not know is that Pabon is also an elementary school teacher. He heads the music program at MPS's Lancaster School.
He stopped by the Lake Effect Studios to chat about his day job gig with education reporter Rachel Morello.
So tell me about your job.
I teach at Lancaster. It's an elementary and middle school, K through 8, in MPS. I teach the whole school. It's around 280 students. There's a full-time art teacher and a full-time music teacher now through the Turnaround Arts program.
And you've been there for a year now, or this is your first year?
This is the first year at that school, yeah. Well, actually, I've been at different schools since 2001, either private or charter schools. This is my first year in the MPS district as an MPS teacher.
Being in MPS, how is that different from the other schools that you've been in?
Well, MPS has a huge network of supportive teachers and staff. Other schools were supportive, but on a smaller scale. There's not a huge difference other than the school climates can be different, depending on who the students are, where they're from, what home life is like, and then what the school life is like. There are some differences as far as responsibilities can be different sometimes. Like there's self-evaluations that we do regularly in MPS, which is actually really positive. You know, we're checking in with ourselves constantly. Other schools have that on a less formal level, in my experience. So there's checks and balances that are more formalized.
As a music teacher, you're obviously, I'm guessing, not sitting at the head of a classroom with a chalkboard behind you. Kids are in desks. You're probably a little more informal of a classroom setting. When I think back to like when I was in music class or art class, and maybe this was just me when I was a kid, but the classroom did kind of feel like more of a playground. You're freer to express yourself just based on the fact that that's what you're doing in those classes. But I would guess as a teacher that you get to see a different side of kids than maybe their math teacher does or their English teacher does.
Yeah, one of the challenging parts of a music classroom in a school where children are used to having desks is that my classroom feels like it could be a playground. Because it's more open concept. If I have chairs out, they'll either be in a circle or in rows, depending on what the activities are. Mm-hmm. either I write on the board or I use digital music programs that, you know, help me teach the material where they can interact with it. We'll do a mixture of singing together, getting out instruments, whether they're rhythm sticks or shakers, bells, drums, ukuleles, and then we'll also have the interactive stuff on the board. In my classroom, volume is usually relatively loud, but it's creative loudness. At least I hope it would be most of the time. You know, trying to get everybody to focus on the same thing can be a challenge. But if it's interesting and engaging, then usually it's not that much of a challenge. I try not to have a distance. I try to hear, you know, hey, can we do this song? Okay, how about we work on this and then we'll do that song. But also talking, especially with some of the middle schoolers, we've been working on songwriting lately, and it's not always just get a staff paper and write on the staff paper. There's a lot of poetry and a lot of, you know, working on literacy concepts that we're doing. And they're taking this poetry to a deeper level. And for me to say, okay, you can't write about that, I feel is going to be more stifling to them. So if we're working on, okay, school concepts, but I don't really want to write about school concepts, can I write about bullying? Because that's what's happening to me and I need to talk about it. Oh yeah, please write it. So we're not only working on, you know, constructing sentences and constructing a story, plot line, beginning, middle, and end, but they're also working on social solutions, social emotional issues and solutions to them. Mm-hmm. That is the learning that I'm interested in supporting and bringing out of kids.
So the reason we're talking is because it's Teacher Appreciation Week?
Yeah, this week.
So in addition to appreciating you and your colleagues, I wanted to ask you who in your past you look to for inspiration as a teacher. Were there people who were really influential to you and that you think about when you're in your own classroom?
Yeah, and actually it doesn't limit itself to just arts teachers. Although some of the most influential teachers in my life were my elementary art teacher, Mr. Heil. He became a best friend because his room was safe. I could be myself. I could talk to him about anything. Anybody could. It was a very safe place to be. Yes, we had to work. We had to focus on our projects, but he didn't try to fit us into a particular square. We could be who we were, and that was an amazing thing to have. I had band teachers that were that way, very supportive. I had a history teacher who was also a coach who, you know, felt like family. It's the relationship with the people where they hear me, they understand me, and they feel safe for me to talk to, and they're willing to go above and beyond. And that's a theme that we have at the school amongst all of our staff and faculty, going above and beyond the call of duty to bring children to a place of learning that is safe and supportive and they can achieve their highest goals.
Can you talk a little bit about working with the other staff in the building? Because I know that MPS has talked about trying to coordinate subjects like music or art with more quote-unquote traditional subjects like math or English, social studies. How much do you coordinate with other teachers?
As far as coordination with other classrooms, I've been collaborating with them regarding what math concepts they're working on, trying to fold fractions into the music, which it's very easy to do because music is math anyway. Mm-hmm. And the notes break down into fractions very easily, quarter notes, one quarter for every whole note. Every whole note, there's four of them, and so on and so forth.
I'm just realizing that I was probably tricked into learning math when I took music as a kid.
You probably were without even knowing.
Wow.
Well, and that's the beauty that you know, I've tried to work with students to understand is, so there's been the math subjects. We touch history, we touch social studies, geography. So I do try to pay attention to what is hanging in the classroom at that time. I try to look around and pay attention to what they're working on and try to fold it in as much as I can. It can be kind of difficult to get all of that planning in because there's not a lot of planning time during the day. But we also have, it's an arts integration model is what we're doing. So teachers are not just relying on the artists to bring their subjects into the arts classrooms. The teachers are also utilizing theatrical skills through the Turnaround Arts program, bringing the arts into a subject. Okay, so this is the subject we're working with. Draw a picture that describes that. They're integrating things in their own ways in their own classrooms to enhance the core subject learning.
So I feel like most of the people I talk to these days who have been in the classroom for a while or who are thinking about becoming teachers, there's a lot of concern there. There's a lot of worry there. And actually in Wisconsin, I think we have a pretty high number of people who are leaving the classroom right now, pretty low number of people going into teaching. And I wonder, even though you've been in classrooms for a number of years now, entering a system like MPS, were you worried at all when you took that job on, or were you excited? What advice would you give to people who are a little concerned about becoming a teacher in the environment that we're in right now?
I'd say ask yourself what you're concerned about. Get in touch with what that really is. I was most concerned about, you know, being in a place where I have good income, steady income, health benefits, you know, being able to support my family the way I need to. That's what's important to me. And being in classrooms where I can make a difference. So if you want to make a difference, be a teacher. If you want to be a billionaire, don't be a teacher. It's a very difficult profession that doesn't necessarily have a huge financial compensation, but I'm not in it for that. Yes, I need to support my family, but at the end of the day, what makes your heart sing?
What's your favorite part of your job?
When I hear all the little and even older kids saying my name, Mr. Pavone, Mr. Pavone, coming up to hug me and saying hello. And I just love, you know, feeling the love and knowing that we're getting somewhere and that we're achieving positive, you know, relationships. And I mean, that's half of it, though. Feeling like we're making progress in that realm is really important. But also seeing the light bulbs go off is the biggest reward for me. Those are the moments that make it worthwhile because, okay, now it all makes sense.
And then on the flip side, I want to know, what do you think is something that people who aren't teachers should know about teachers?
If you don't know what it's like to have 25 to 35 kids in one room by yourself for 45 minutes to an hour or even all day, which most of the teachers have 30 different personalities, 30 different ways of behaving. If you don't know what that's like, step into a classroom someday, experience it, and please thank a teacher. This is by far one of the most difficult, emotionally difficult professions because you are asked to manage all of these different ways of thinking and being while trying to mold a person into an independent, creative, positive thinker and doer where they can take the information you give them and create something impactful and helpful in our community and in our world.
Thanks to
it's
you.
It's huge. Thank you.
Well, thank this teacher, and I know you got to get back to class.
Thanks, yeah.
But is there anything that you wanted to add about your job or about your students or your school?
Well, one more thing to people thinking about being teachers. I'm saying how, you know, intense it is, but it's also equally most rewarding. When it goes right, everything is in balance. Everything feels great. And it's worthwhile because you're helping shape our future. We're not doing something insignificant. So if you're interested in being a teacher, please remember that it's probably the most significant profession that you're looking into. And you will make a difference in someone's lives. If you don't make a difference in all 35 children's lives at once, you are making a difference in their lives without even knowing it. We all had teachers that influenced us. We all have teachers that helped inspire us to be who we are today.
Julio Pavone is the music teacher at MPS's Lancaster School. He spoke with Lake Effect's Rachel Morello during Teacher Appreciation Week.
So many things are automated these days. Well, how soon will our cars drive us without our help? Well, we'll find out when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. We live in an increasingly automated world. Smartphones not only access the web, they can also track the distance we've traveled and control our televisions, lighting, and furnaces. Manufacturing is ever more mechanized. What used to take many physical steps can often be taken care of by a click of a mouse or a swipe of a finger across a screen.
But there are still many things that require human intervention. Despite Roomba technology, we still have to clean our homes. And for now, at least, we still have to drive our cars. But for how long? Lake Effect Auto contributors Mark Savage and Dan Harmon join us now to consider the fully automated vehicle.
A lot of this is happening from companies that are not necessarily automotive companies. They're the ones driving, no pun intended, that are driving this whole effort. So, and it seems like the actual automotive manufacturers are a little late to the game as far as catching up to Google and Uber and others that are not specifically car companies or tech companies. So why is it that the tech companies are going there before the auto companies?
Well, I guess we probably shouldn't be too surprised. That's the cynical side of me talking, but it makes sense. The technical side of this is all computer programming and sensors and this is high science, and whether it's Ubers and Googles and so forth out there in the world and the companies that are supporting them with all of the technology, they're looking. These are creative thinkers thinking out of the box and moving down the road. Car companies are kind of being dragged along because they're old technology. You know, we had to drag them into hybrids and electrics and so forth just to try and – if the government hadn't said that you had to have better gas mileage, we'd still have 1968 Dodges out there, you know, getting 5 miles to the gallon and with a lot of tailpipe emissions. I mean, because people were buying them. So the market is changing, and now this market is changing with the younger generation that is – used to their cell phones and Uber and people, things like that, they're used to being able to do something on their cell phone. And the car is an appliance. It is a refrigerator. It's a stove. It's a toaster. It does what you want it to do. And now you shouldn't even have to drive it. You should just be able to dial it up on your phone. A car will appear in your driveway. You get in it. It will take you to work, to the mall, to, I don't know, cafe, whatever.
Buy another cell phone.
Another Starbucks.
Smartphone, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I just find it interesting that this is being pushed forward by tech companies. Of course, they would have a lot to gain by this becoming a reality.
They have a lot to gain, and that they're looking at this as an expansion of their market. I think the unintended consequence for the car companies will be we don't really need so many car companies because there's going to be no difference in the cars as far as their performance. I mean, maybe they'll still have some with bigger engines and so forth, but at some point it will be mandated that we're not allowed to drive anymore and that we'll all have to have autonomous cars. So if that's the case, do you care if you're in a car labeled a Jaguar or a Lexus or a Mercedes, or do you care if it's labeled a just plain old GM? They may not even have a brand. It may just be a GM, Ford, or Toyota. Because it's going to be the appliance that just picks you up and takes you to work and takes you where you want to go. And I'm assuming most of us won't even own one of these eventually, which to me means we need a whole lot less cars out there, which is going to cut a lot into our 17 million cars that we make a year in this country. So I think those are the unintended consequences that we will see 10, 12 years down the road, especially the littler car companies. They'll just disappear pretty quickly.
Well, it seems like the tech companies can only go so far. Like, for example, Google is now they're working with an automotive manufacturer, right? Because
correct,
they can only go so far. They can do the electronics and the tracking, but actually, when it comes to making a car, at some point they have to actually work with a manufacturer.
Well, right. I mean, it started out that Google wanted to make their own car, and they had some little cute little thing, and this is going to be their new cute little car that they'll have. Well, that's great, and you can do a lot of technology development and prototyping and so forth. But then it hits you at one point, hey, we have to have a $3 billion factory to create one of these or thousands of these. You know, Chrysler down the road can do this because they already got all the facilities. All they got to do is put it on an assembly line and crank it out for us. So right now, Google is working with Chrysler. They've got a Pacifica minivan, which is a hybrid, so now it's got that technology in there too, that they're developing some of these. And they're working with a couple other car companies to a smaller degree. And I think what you'll see is they will start licensing all the technology to these people, to the different car companies. They'll make things, and whether Google sells it or whether they just take a cut for the technology that they have provided for that particular vehicle, I don't know. But they're going to make money off of this, which is good for them. And the car companies that work with these folks will continue to build cars, you know, for the foreseeable future. So it will be interesting to see what all happens. But, yeah, they've given up the idea of building their own car, and now they've labeled their mobility, you know, autonomous mobility part of the thing, Waymo. So we'll be saying Waymo instead of Google in the future, I guess.
And a lot of this technology is already in a lot of cars you can get, and you refer to it as semi-autonomous.
Right.
It seems like Tesla is the one that's pushed it the furthest right now, but a lot of cars have lane departure warning and automatic braking, which are all part of it. Is this just a stepping stone to fully autonomous?
Right. I would say about half the cars I drive now I would call semi-autonomous in that they have all those things you just mentioned. You know, you can – I have driven down the highway and with a very light touch on the wheel or no touch on the wheel and watch the car correct as we go from one side of the lane to the other because it sees the side markers and it pushes you back to the middle of the lane. Some of them just beep. Some of them flash lights. They all have different ways of dealing with it. When it actually corrects your steering, which is what a lot of the lane departure systems do now, in addition to giving you a light or a buzz, yeah, that's pretty close to being able to just let the car drive itself. And I think the big challenge in our climate will be how does it read the side and center line markers when there's snow and ice and so forth. And I'm sure that there's ways for them to do that. I think that that's just not – they haven't quite got that as developed as far as all of us would like it to be. You know, it's not like having an automatic pilot just yet, but it's getting there. And I think in the past we've said it's probably 5 or 6 years down the road that we're going to see this. And I think it's now 2 or 3 years down the road that we're going to start seeing some of these actually for sale.
What has to happen as far as infrastructure for this to really happen?
Well, it depends on the systems. And that may be something that all the automakers and tech companies will have to decide on is – how are we going to do this? There's been talk of doing, you know, sensors in the highways and stuff. I think that's just highly impractical because you can't – that would basically mean we have to remake every city street and every highway in the country to put sensors in. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think there's the money for that nor the patience for the public to have all of our highways torn up even more than they are already. So I think it will depend on the technology and if they can get the cars to read the roads safely as they are right now. And I have a pretty good hunch that this is going to happen pretty quickly now.
Well, right now it's essentially a combination of satellite, right, just satellite navigation,
yeah,
and the car's ability to sense things, whether that be with a camera or radar.
Right, satellite navigation, radar, and sensors tell you everything you pretty much need to know. Now, how will it work when it snows?
Well, what happened with Tesla when the one car ran into a truck? It didn't see it. Did it not see it because of photography or because of radar or what failed there?
I'm guessing that a sensor didn't read the truck as an obstacle. It saw it as a – because I believe it was a white truck. I think it just read it as open space, and so it went right underneath the truck. Not a good thing, and most of us would like to not do that. That's really tough on your cranium.
So. Yeah, it's a little – yeah. Hard to get over that one.
Yeah.
Well, so that person died. Yes,
that person died in that one, right.
And do we know yet if that was – I mean, I think Tesla was saying it was operator error and, you know, of course, people are claiming otherwise.
Well, I think – yeah.
Do we know actually what was determined?
I don't know that they've made a final determination on it, but I think that what you'll see is that for the next year or two as these systems get all the bugs out of them, there's going to be accidents and bumps and, you know, things in the road here.
And fatalities.
And it's going to necessitate that, yes, a driver still can control the car. And while we all have this vision of everyone sitting looking at their cell phone and playing games and looking at Google and all the various things online, I think we're going to have to pay attention at least for the next couple of years until the bugs are all worked out and be ready to grab the wheel or be ready to apply the brakes when something gets in the way.
Something Volvo said, or it's a claim that Volvo has made, and I find it very intriguing, which is that they, at a certain point, I'm not sure what year it is, it might just be 2020, I don't know.
I think it's 2020, right.
That no one will die in their cars. No one will ever die in a crash because of the various safety. They're not even claiming autonomous driving. They're just saying because of the safety mechanisms in there that it just won't and can't happen.
Well, right. And we're getting closer and closer. Obviously, there's so many variables and accidents that I think that it's going to be real, real difficult to get to zero. But I think we're going to see that number just go down, 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 because between the airbags and the sensors and the driving aids that are out there right now, I mean, the car I'm driving currently, if you're on the highway and you know it has the dynamic radar or cruise control, so somebody pulls in front of you and your car immediately slows down. Now, that's great if everybody else has the same system, because then the car behind you slows down. But it's the guy behind you that doesn't have that, that doesn't see you slow down by 10 mile an hour because someone pulled in front of you, that now rear ends you and causes some sort of a problem. So, yeah, all this stuff takes a little bit of time, but we're getting there.
What is the big driving force behind autonomous cars? Is it the wow factor or is it safety? I mean, it's Volvo saying that. It's very compelling. So that if these systems are in place and no one's going to die or incur a serious injury, that to me is a big selling point. But I don't really ever hear it couched that way or phrased that way, that this is what the point of it is, or is it just doing it because we can?
Well, Volvo is good at marketing safety, and that's what it's done for, you know, 30, 40 years here.
But other manufacturers and even Google are not making this claim about safety.
No, and I think that's what's interesting, is that Volvo has kind of pushed the envelope on that end of it, and they're trying to say that certainly that their cars will be that safe, and they're hoping that all cars are that safe. My guess is that theirs will be there sooner than some of the others. I think safety is an important part of it, and I think people will buy into that. I think it's just a change in lifestyles and attitudes, and the fact that people are much more comfortable with technology controlling many aspects of their life and being a part of that of their life, a bigger part of their life than it had been in the past. The cynical side of me would say that I think some people are just very lazy and don't want to have to drive their cars anymore. I enjoy driving a car. I think some people enjoy the power that you feel, the control you feel. And, you know, if you're on the right roads, it can be a lot of fun driving your car and cornering it. And it's a mental challenge and a physical challenge. But with more and more people happy to use Uber to get where they want to go or to use an autonomous car to go where they want to go, it's certainly – That's the driving marketing factor of this, is that I know more and more people, usually under 30 at this point, that don't own a car because they're taking the Ubers and having friends drive them or taking mass transit, which is wonderful. But I think that there's just less and less need for a car.
Well, having just spent a lot of time on the West Coast and Northwest, it's immediately noticeable that drivers in the Midwest are not as polite. So I'm wondering if, you know, maybe that's a good selling point too. You won't get involved in as many, you know, fracases with other drivers or road rage incidents if the car is to blame.
That's possible. That's possible. Maybe road rage will decline, and that's a good thing. You know, maybe there'll be fewer fatalities from the after the accident interactions.
All right. Well, another curious thing to me is, for example, will people be able to go out in their autonomous car and have a few too many drinks, and coming home, are they immune from prosecution, or is that a whole other question? Like, what will happen as far as laws and law enforcement catching up with this?
Well, I don't think the law enforcement and laws have caught up with this at this point. I would hesitate to say that maybe in Milwaukee, where we enjoy our beer, and Wisconsin, where we enjoy our mixed drinks a lot, this might be a boon to people being able to stay out late and drink and then get home safely. That's great. But I don't know that ultimately they'll be held scot-free. Right now, I think it's fine because no one's looking at the laws and saying, hey, wait a minute, what if you're in an autonomous car and you're in an accident and you're drunk, but maybe the autonomous car couldn't understand what you said because you slurred your words. I don't know.
All right. Yeah, no, and the other part of that is insurance. I'm wondering what the insurance company thinks of all this.
Well, the insurance company will love the fact that cars are not banging into each other and causing damage, because that will reduce their costs. I don't know if that'll reduce your insurance rates dramatically, but as we've mentioned in a couple of past discussions, a lot of this will come down to when there is an accident and you're in an autonomous car, and are you at fault, or is the car company that made the car at fault, or is the software companies at fault because something didn't work right? And it may be that every one of these will be a different case, and depending on what the circumstances are, different people will be held liable, but somebody's going to be held liable, and the attorneys of the world are going to make sure of that. So somebody's going to be held liable when there's an accident with an autonomous car.
All right. And just maybe this is a whole other interview, but I'm curious about the changes that are going to happen in automotive design, because at some point you may not need a steering wheel, an accelerator, and a brake pedal. You may not even need to face forward. Maybe we'll go back to the age of the carriage, when you had essentially two love seats facing each other, and you know, you don't need to have a cockpit, if you will.
No, that is very possible. Like I say, other than being able to program in where you want to go, I don't know that we'll need all that. And it may be that we'll see a lot more pod-like cars that are one or two passenger things that take you where you want to go. I think if I'm Uber, I'm looking at still having something that can carry four people so I can get more people in the car. And if somebody's commuting to work, I can make three stops along the way and pick up three or four people and take them to work. But I think, yeah, I think the whole interior of the car is going to be a, you know, totally different place. It may just be about lights and electrical hookups so you can see what you're doing.
And maybe we'll have cars again that have comfortable rides.
Well, yes, they can spend more time giving us a smooth ride on the car, because nothing else will matter. Handling won't matter at all. BMW may take this the toughest, because it won't matter if I have the ultimate driving machine, because I'm not driving it anymore. I'm just going to be a passenger. So, yeah. And what's an SUV matter? You know, you don't need to. Maybe all the cars will have all-wheel drive and just take you wherever you need to go. And I'm not sure how this is going to work for towing boats and trailers and so forth. But you know, like I say, the next 5 or 10 years will determine that. But the little pod cars and things that'll be out there sooner, taking us to and from work, will be the quicker builds here.
What's your prediction on when we're going to see the first one, the first truly autonomous car that you can buy?
I'm going to say 2 to 3 years max.
Wow. Okay.
I think it's going to come quicker than we ever thought possible. And I know I'm changing my tune from a year or so ago, but this stuff's coming quick.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if is it going to have some kind of special light on it or something that says it's in autonomous mode.
I would think that would make sense. I mean, now they're already talking that hybrid cars or electric cars have to have sounds that they make so that they don't run over people that step off the curb. So it would make sense to me. If I'm driving behind a car, I want to know it's in autonomous mode, because first of all, one of the things we'll have to get used to is we're going to go places a lot slower than they went in the past, because the cars will drive the speed limit. So when you get on the highway, you're going to be going 50 or 55, whatever it says, instead of 60 or 65 like most people currently drive. So if it took you a half an hour to get to work, it may take you 40 minutes to get to work now, but it'll all be controlled by the car. And yeah, and if I'm behind that car, I want to know, because I know it's not going to accelerate as quick. It's going to follow all the speed laws exactly to the letter. It's good to know.
Well, I'll talk to you in a few years and see if your prediction comes
hopefully,
true.
Hopefully I'm here in my autonomous car next time, you know, and I'll just ride downtown, and this will be nice. I won't have to worry about all the traffic.
Well, another follow-up question, which is, can it drop you off where you want to go and then go park itself and then come back and pick you up?
You know, that may be the best question yet. I don't know. I would guess that eventually that will be true.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Mark.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Mark Savage writes the auto review column Savage on Wheels for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and SavageOnWheels.com. He's also the executive editor of American Snowmobiler Magazine and editor of Fine Scale Modeler Magazine, both part of Kalmbach Publishing in Waukesha. He joins contributor Dan Harmon each month to talk about cars.
We have enough time today to showcase a little music. Guitarists, singers, and songwriters Sarah and Kenny were on the show about a year and a half ago. Since then, they've moved to Italy, where Sarah is from. They've toured around Europe, and they're now ended up in London.
But they're back in the Milwaukee area, where Kenny is from, for the next few weeks. We'll have a full interview with them next week, but for now, here is one of the songs they performed for us called Pictures of a New Life.
Pictures of a new life, feeling of a heart's bite. Gotta be free enough to write, enough to care. senseless starving you can't reach. You're feeding monsters you can't see. If only I had, I never wanna hear again. Enough for tears. Years of learning.
The duo Sarah and Kenny with their new tune, Pictures of a New Life. The full interview we did with them will air next Monday. And it wraps up today's show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and each weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It is 11 o'clock.